Well, there's no denying that we have some great content today talking about fetal monitoring, but you know where else there is some great content? It's over at Brian and my other project, the Intensive Care Academy, where you will find, oh gosh, nearly 40 hours right now of video lessons online that you can watch at your own pace, getting into all kinds of critical care topics from the very general to the very specialized, and we think you will love it. You also get access to a couple of private podcast feeds with even more material, some live hangouts with us, and a whole bunch more. Check it out if you have not, ICU101.com. Otherwise, let's get to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back to the podcast. This is Brian Bowling. With me as always is Brandon Odo.
Hello.
And today we are going to talk about a subject that strikes more fear into the hearts of critical care providers than just about anything. And no, it's not children, although that's a close second. It's worse. It's worse than children. It's children who aren't quite done yet.
Pre-children.
It's pre-children. It's what do you do when the pregnant person shows up in your ICU? We just did SimLab the other day with our fellows, and we had a scenario where a woman was postpartum. And just the fact that she was postpartum threw them so much that they couldn't figure out what was going on because they were so locked in on this had to be an OB problem. And it wasn't. It just was an incidental finding. But this
there's a lot of mystery.
Yeah, this is the sort of thing that causes normally very put together, very capable providers to sort of flip out, forget what they're doing, and melt into a gelatinous puddle of goo.
And, you know, like the treating these problems is sort of its own thing. But I feel like, as with many situations, treatment can be actually be easier because you could always ask somebody. But how you like monitor patients is almost more complex because that's what you're doing when you're not doing anything. So the patient who's sick, who's pregnant, we could do our things. But there's always this thing in your mind like, well, what else should I be doing?
Right,
I mean, you
right,
can like
right.
stare at their blood pressure and you're like, but aren't there like other things?
Right. And I think that was the thing that was throwing my students off in the SimLab the other day was they just wanted to consult OBGYN. And I was like, but I don't think this is an OBGYN problem, guys.
And they're not going to sit next to you like, in the ICU all day.
Yeah. Yeah. and we have had pregnant people in our ICU, and the nurses also kind of freak out, and they want nurses from labor hall to come and just hang out. And they're like, we have actual patients that are giving birth right now. We can't just do that. So anyway, we thought we'd talk about it. And I mean, Brandon and I are pretty much experts on everything, but we figured we should probably have someone on who really actually knows what they're talking about. So we called our old friend, Stephanie Martin. You may remember Dr. Martin from our episode on AFE, amniotic fluid embolism, from a ways back. She's a maternal fetal medicine specialist and the medical director and co-owner of Clinical Concepts in Obstetrics. So she is an OB person who does high risk. She does essentially, would you call it OB ICU? Is that what MFM is a lot of ways?
Yeah, I mean, a maternal fetal medicine specialist is somebody who's completed an OB residency of 4 years. And then we do an extra 3 years of training to learn how to take care of the higher risk patient in addition to genetics and ultrasound and all that kind of stuff. But we do have to be prepared to take care, and we're trained to take care of critically ill pregnant women. Now, that said, some people are more comfortable with it than others. But yes, that's what we're trained to do. And it happens to be my passion. So I'm one of those people that just, you know, that person in the ICU is, I'm the one who's wanting to go see the patient and talk to everybody about her and get involved in the care and everything, because I know, I mean, I have great empathy for everybody involved because it's terrifying to have a pregnant woman up in the ICU. I mean, I always joke when I'm teaching that if you want to scare the ICU, bring a baby warmer into the mom's room.
Yeah, we actually, a couple of months ago, we had a we came in and there was a baby warmer sitting in the neuro ICU, and it was there simply because somebody was taking it somewhere and they needed to drop it off for a minute, and everyone kind of freaked out.
It's like,
why is your baby warmer here?
Yeah, and I've delivered babies in the ICU, both vaginally and by C-section, women on vents, women conscious, women not. And it's terrifying for everybody involved. We don't like it either.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah. We'd rather be in an operating room or down on labor and delivery where we need to be, but sometimes that's just not possible. So I love being able to help ICU teams really understand what they need to know, because we can't know it all, and who your partners are, and, you know, kind of what are the highlights of things you need to take into consideration when you have a pregnant woman in your ICU, because it will happen no matter where you are. Yeah. You're going to encounter a pregnant woman who needs special care. I mean, COVID really highlighted it for everybody. It was like to the nth degree, but it happens all the time. Mm-hmm.
Because pregnant people are, you know, can still get all the things normal people get. Let us just say that someone is working in some sort of general ICU, let's say a medical ICU, and a pregnant woman turns up. And I don't think the details are too important here. Let's just say she's, 25, maybe G1, P0. And let's say the pregnancy is at about 28 weeks. And let's say she turns up with maybe COVID pneumonia and she's requiring high-flow nasal cannula. The sort of thing that we're all very comfortable dealing with in its own right, but there's this wrinkle that she's pregnant. So let me just first ask you, and this may be completely wrong or maybe it's semi-right, but intuitively it seems like the first big decision point here determining how the pregnancy plays a role is whether it's potentially viable, I mean, just based on the gestational age, because it seems like a lot of what you're dealing with monitoring the fetus and deciding what to do about it, it depends on whether the baby needs to come out now, early. And that must depend on whether the baby being delivered could be viable. And of course, at some ages, they may be and some they're not. Is that a fair generalization to make? Because then, of course, if it's a very early pregnancy, then we could have a whole different conversation versus someone who's like near term. I'm sure some things apply no matter how far along, but...
Well, you have hit on the issue. So the very first question that has to be asked is, are we looking to deliver this baby if there is potentially a problem? So is the baby viable is foundation number one. Now, limits of viability are approximately 23 to 24 weeks gestation, assuming nothing else is going on. Baby is not physically abnormal. There's no genetic abnormalities, whatever. Let's just assume we have an otherwise normal pregnancy and the baby is 23 to 24 weeks. That's the limit of viability. That doesn't mean there's guaranteed survival. Quite the contrary. Very high mortality rates. Outcomes are mixed, you know, so it's not...
But it means they cannot survive at less than that.
Well, there have been... Some babies will survive between 22 and 23. But we don't, generally speaking, we don't consider the limit of viability lower unless you are in a very highly specialized center. Mom and dad have been very extensively counseled about outcomes and desires for intervention, but we don't routinely intervene just because they're 22. At 23, it's much more consistent intervention. In 24, pretty much everybody's going to recommend or at least have conversations with the parents about their desires for full intervention. And every week beyond that, survival and outcomes improve fairly dramatically. Well, actually, day by day, they improve dramatically. A few days make a difference in a 24-week baby with them staying pregnant. So
the way to think about this is kind of like we have a patient who could need a valve replacement, and then you've asked the surgeons to come say, and they say, oh, this patient is not a candidate for that surgery, just no way, no how, because of other factors, anatomic factors or risks or whatever, or perhaps they are. And that changes how we think, because then it's an option that may or may not be on the table. If it can't happen, then there's no reason to give it more thought. We have to do other things. That's never a possibility. If it can happen, doesn't mean that it should happen, but it's at least part of the conversation.
Absolutely. So, like, for example, if someone is 18 weeks pregnant, there is no universe where delivery of that baby results in a survivor. That doesn't happen. It's not possible, no matter how good the medical care is. But if someone is 23 to 24, we've got a reasonable enough likelihood of survival. We're going to consider intervening. However, The real caveat here, so you have to have a minimum gestational age where you have to be considering that survival is a possibility. So there's that. The other thing to recognize is that for us as OB people, the earlier the pregnancy, the harder the monitor is to interpret, because the monitor represents maturity of the brain, not the heart. So your heart rate is controlled by your brain, not your heart, unless you have heart block. Okay. So your brain is controlling the variability and all the things that we see on the monitor. So very immature babies, very premature babies, they're harder to interpret those monitoring tracings, and they're physically harder to follow in mom. And especially if mom is obese or has other things going on with her abdomen, even a lot of scar tissue, or maybe she's had a recent surgery or whatever, it can be physically challenging to pick up the heartbeat and monitor it for any consecutive period of time when the baby is quite small. So there's some logistical issues with monitoring very early babies. Then as you get farther along, the next question we have to ask is, okay, we might have a survivor in here, but are you willing to intervene on behalf of the baby? And what does intervention mean for mom and baby? So you might have a mom who's critically ill and not stable for major abdominal surgery should a cesarean be required. And let's not forget, a cesarean is major abdominal surgery. I mean, everything's non-invasive and minimally invasive now, you know, so it's not that common that we open the abdomen with a 10 centimeter incision, you know, outside of trauma or other situations. I mean, people just generally do it in a more minimally invasive approach. So this is a big surgery and she's critically ill. So we're going to be balancing maternal and fetal risks. And that's a conversation that everybody has to have together before you have a crashing mom and a crashing baby. And we all want to run back and do a cesarean. So are we willing to take the risks that would be necessary to accomplish delivery, which might be a cesarean, it might not be.
And I imagine we could extend that, because if you have a pre-viable pregnancy, could there still be cases where you say this will not result in a living baby, but could be the best thing for the mother's survivor?
Yes, survival. And the two most obvious scenarios there in our world are an infection in the uterus, typically where mom has broken her bag of water and has now developed an infection in the uterus. The uterus has to be emptied. She might be in septic shock, but we have to empty the uterus, okay? And that's typically inducing, but it could be cesarean in some patients. That's a case-by-case scenario. But infection doesn't mean you have to have a cesarean, but she might have another reason to need a cesarean, for example. The other is hemorrhage. If the patient is hemorrhaging from the uterus, you're going to have to stop the bleeding at some point. She could be in hemorrhagic shock, or she could be having like a hypertensive issue and be abrupting and separating the placenta, and that can hemorrhage liters in minutes. You know, the blood flow to the uterus at term is 500 cc's per minute minimum. So they can hemorrhage rapidly and you have to intervene. So those are probably the two most common scenarios where we see, and they'll be, you know, delivered, you know, because we have no choice. We have to, you can't stabilize the mom without the birth, whether the baby is going to make it or not.
Yeah, it certainly makes you reflect on how unusual the situation is, though, because outside of like mass casualties and things, we don't usually have to weigh the good of two different people. In this case, you may be, and then you're, if you have a consentable person or their family, now I guess you're asking how do you want to weigh these risks? And because no, maybe you can't, you know, have the best outcome for everyone. That, I'm glad I don't have to have those conversations a lot, but.
Well, and the step that I see missed, I see two steps missed in this situation. One is people assume that viable baby means we must monitor the baby continuously in the ICU, but you really shouldn't be even starting that until you have evaluated whether or not you're willing and able to intervene on behalf of the baby. And intervention in our world typically means delivery, but it doesn't have to. It could mean changing her position, improving her blood pressure, you know, transfusing her, whatever it may be that would improve the baby's condition, because we can see on the monitor maybe mom's hypoxic or she's acidotic or whatever, and we are going to see those changes on the fetal heart rate monitor, so we can say, hey, we're not necessarily headed towards delivery here, but we need to improve flow to the uterus, just as an example. But if you're not willing to deliver, if delivery's off the table, then why are we monitoring? And people forget to make that connection. They just assume pregnant in the ICU must monitor. And now we start seeing problems and we're panicking and we're running back and we haven't necessarily stabilized mom appropriately.
So this is the old question of don't do a test if you don't have some, you know, something you can act on. And that's obviously a better conversation to have when there's some more time to have it, rather than assuming that you're going to rush to some sort of intervention when actually that was never on the table. And that has impacts that go all the way back to the monitoring you're doing and so on. And I can imagine that it might be an inner team thing. Like maybe the ICU team is assuming that if something happens, OB is going to rush in and like cut this baby out. And then there's no world where they're going
to
do that.
Well, and that's why it's so important to have these conversations with the patient, with her, whoever her decision makers are, if she's, you know, is currently incapacitated or is anticipated to deteriorate to that point. Everybody needs to be on board on that. And the ICU teams and the OB teams need to be talking together about what that means, because some of the things we might take into account is how likely do we think mom is to respond to our therapies? And what does that typically look like? I'll give you an example. DKA is a great example. Okay. DKA, mom's acidotic. Your baby is going to be acidotic. It's the law of physiology. If mom is acidotic, baby is going to be acidotic. So if you put that baby on the monitor, you are going to see a tracing that is going to make you want to deliver that baby, because it is the monitoring is determined to tell us whether or not the baby's acidotic. So baby's acidotic and we're going to be tempted to deliver. So we have a choice. Are we going to resuscitate this baby in the mother? And as mother resuscitates, baby resuscitates? Or are we going to deliver a baby that is acidotic and put it in its own ICU and then resuscitate it? Because it's going to have to be resuscitated. It's either going to happen in mom or in its own neonatal ICU. And that comes down to what's the reason for the DKA? How likely do we think she is to respond? And in obstetrics, they typically respond very quickly, very well. I'm sure you guys have seen this, because they don't even get DKA at blood sugars that are that high. I mean, I've had patients with DKA with blood sugars of 160, 170. And it's just the pregnancy changes. They're not 800. You know, they're not off the meter. So they respond quicker. Baby responds quicker. And within a couple of hours, your tracing looks better.
All right. So probably some of our audience has some experience with some of these tools. Maybe they had a child or they had a patient. But let's assume we don't. Let's say just someone, you get on the elevator with them and they say, you know, we put patients on cardiac telemetry, you monitor their blood pressure, their pulse oximetry, and so on. What other things do I need to do with a pregnant patient who's critically ill? And how does that generally work?
Yeah, so number one is you've got to make sure they're not flat on their back. So if the uterus is at the belly button, or they are 20 weeks or above, and at 20 weeks, the uterus is typically at the belly button because that's the bifurcation of the aorta vena cava. So roughly in a normal anatomic position, right? Now, if the patient is beyond 20 weeks, that uterus is going to compress the aorta vena cava. It's going to impact your flow in and out of the heart, and you're going to have potentially hypotension. You're going to have decreased cardiac output, et cetera. It's going to create an issue. So she needs to be tilted to one side. You can just literally put a pillow under her hip or sit her up a little bit or whatever it may be so that her uterus is not flat on her back. So that's number one. And any pregnant people who have been pregnant or currently pregnant listening to this, they know how yucky they feel when they lay flat on their back. It's just, they feel.
So just elevating the head of the bed, yep, to like 30 degrees, is that adequate? That's sort of our usual.
For the vast majority of patients, that's going to be absolutely fine. Yes. Or you can just tilt them to the side if they have to be flat. Even in CPR, you know, or you've got to be getting the uterus off. And that can, when you're doing compressions, you're literally physically manhandling the uterus and moving it off to one side or the other so it's not compressing the aorta or the vena cava. So that's number one. Once you've got this patient where the uterus is off, then you're going to make the decision, should this baby be monitored or not? And that's typically with literal monitors that they're about the size of your palm that fit on the uterus and are held with elastic bands. One monitors the heart rate, one monitors the uterus looking for contractions. And then we interpret what that looks like. It makes a tracing, and commonly there's a nurse at the bedside. Sometimes it's transmitted down. And then we look at it and say, okay, is this normal for gestational age or is it not? Do we have any signs that this baby is either acidotic or not getting adequate oxygen delivery? Now, we often talk about the fetal heart rate monitor as like its own like swan, central line. Like you are getting continuous hemodynamic patterns because if a patient is critically ill and the body has to make decisions about distribution of cardiac output. So, you know, where I've got limited cardiac output, I'm not doing so great. How important are all my organs, right? So liver, lung, heart, and brains, that's at the top. And then we've got kidneys and gut, and uterus is like as low as can possibly go on the list. So one of the first things that's going to happen is blood is going to get shunted away from the uterus to provide oxygen and blood flow to all the other more vital organs in the hierarchy of the body. And we're going to see evidence of that on the monitor. We're going to see fetal heart rate changes that tell us we're not getting great flow. We need to do what we can to improve uterine perfusion and maybe improve the situation for the baby, even if delivery is not necessary.
So we'll sometimes say like the first organ that gets annoyed when someone is in shock or other distress maybe is the kidneys, but no, perhaps it's the uterus. And we might look at the patient and say, oh, they're fine, but the uterus is like the first canary in the coal mine saying, I mean, you guys are fine, but...
Yes, it's at the expense of the baby. And what will we see? We'll see, number one, contractions. The uterus is a muscle. And if it's not getting adequate blood flow, it's going to start getting twitchy. And so we'll see evidence of contractions. Then the next thing we'll see is that the baby, we can see evidence that of what we call late decelerations, where the heart rate does not handle a contraction because contraction cuts off all blood flow to the baby. So the baby actually has to be able to hold its breath temporarily. Most of us are going to be fine if we hold our breath temporarily, just like an unborn baby. They can do it for a minute, maybe a minute and a half, and then it's not going to work anymore. And you're going to start seeing changes. And so we can say, hey, we need to improve perfusion or maybe improve oxygenation, whatever is happening that is not that the uterus is responding. But it's that canary in the coal mine is the perfect analogy. Little baby canary.
And so the two things you're monitoring are whether the uterus is contracting, which if the patient is not in labor, should not be at all.
Well, right? Actually, contractions are very normal, but there's a matter of frequency and intensity. So it's a muscle, it's going to contract occasionally, but we don't want to see regular frequent contractions. And then contractions just may be a sign that the muscle's irritable. Quite frankly, it rarely turns into labor. It could, but most of these patients don't just spontaneously labor and have their babies, even though they're critically ill. It's just an irritable muscle. I mean,
And those contractions provide sort of a stress test to the fetus, and you can see how they respond to them.
In fact, we call it a non-stress test when they're not contracting. And when they are contracting, we call it a contraction stress test. So yes, you're exactly right.
Okay. And the heart rate side of it, this is not an EKG. You're just monitoring the rate.
We're monitoring the rate, the variability, and in simplistic terms, how squiggly is it? So we don't want
variability in the rate.
Within the rate. So we establish, there's criteria that establish a baseline heart rate, which is typically 110 to 160 beats per minute. And then we want to see how much variability, how squiggly that line is. It should look very zigzag a lot. And we measure that by the amount of change in like 5 to 10 or 6 to 10 beats per minute change or greater than 25 beats per minute change in a period of time. So we look at that, and that indicates brain health.
Because you should have some like your heart rate should not be 60 exactly. It should go to 65 to 70 to 56, whatever, over time.
Yes.
In response to stress or in response to nothing, that's normal.
It's very normal and expected. And as that variability goes down, and we have very clear definitions for what this is, as the variability goes down and becomes minimal or absent, the likelihood of an acidotic baby skyrockets.
It's an interesting marker because it's not something we talk about in other situations, although I think there are now some physiologic monitors that like athletes are using to look at their heart rate variability. So if you're a runner or something, then you may have some like this lexicon maybe in your head. But certainly in like the medical world, we don't use heart rate variability for much else. I'm sure someone's researching that, but... And this is done by, what is it, Doppler?
Yes, it's a Doppler. Exactly.
Okay. So it's not electrical the same way we do, you know, other telemetry and so on. And I imagine, like you're saying, that makes it somewhat positional. If you're not aiming your Doppler beam at the fetus, you're not going to see it.
Exactly. And it can be over the umbilical cord and not the heart. So it can come and go. Like you might have it because they're in water. So they're moving around and they can change position, and you've got to, and it's sound waves with this Doppler. So if there's a lot in between the surface of the skin and the baby's heartbeat, that's a lot of tissue that the sound has to travel through. So it can be difficult to actually capture the heart rate continuously. Sometimes we're hand holding it.
So if you lose your good signal and someone has to come move it, that's a very normal thing. Of course that happens sometimes with our adult patients and, you know, one of their leads comes off, but it's sort of obvious how it could more easily happen with like a tiny floating fetus.
Yes. And we do internal monitoring as well, but only for patients in labor. And we attach a little electrode to the scalp. It's just a little wire that just screws underneath the scalp and gives us continuous monitoring. But that's only, they have to be dilated and in labor to do that with a broken bag of water. So in the ICU, you're not really going to see that unless you're laboring a patient up in the ICU, which hopefully you don't see that very often.
And just, I always have an easier time understanding all the things that we look for and worry about in medicine by understanding what would happen if you didn't. So you are monitoring for fetal distress as kind of a physiologic marker. What does that entail? Let's say you had a very distressed fetus because the host was very distressed and ill, and you completely ignored it. What would be the negative outcome here?
So,
like a fetal demise?
Yes, or damage. So we don't use the term fetal distress is really a layperson's term. You will hear OB people using it because it's very old terminology in our world. But what we're actually looking for is, how likely is this baby to be acidotic? Because acidosis leads to brain damage, leads to encephalopathy, leads to neurologic injury that can be permanent. And ultimately, if the cycle is not interrupted, if the process is not interrupted, stillbirth. So
ignoring these things and not either getting the baby out or fixing the mother so that the baby is happier could mean either a baby that doesn't survive or a baby that is born with some, you know, damage and deficits because they've been really, we're talking about the brain like you're talking about. So they have a period of time where they had perhaps ischemia to the brain.
Especially if they're premature, because premature babies have very premature circulations. And so their brain vasculature and their brain anatomy is very susceptible to injury. So like, for example, cerebral palsy is, you know, what common survivors of neurologic injury commonly have, because it's a classic pattern of vulnerability in a premature baby's brain. So these children grow up and have very similar patterns of disability because of how similarly immature those brains are and their blood flow. So, but that loss, that there's things that scare people, and it's beyond the immediacy of having to deliver in the ICU or rush a patient from the ICU to wherever distant OR she might be going to, but it's having a claim that the baby was damaged because they failed to intervene when they should have, or a stillbirth occurs, and that they could have prevented it had they delivered earlier. But the question really is, at what cost? Because there's always maternal risk. There's risks of staying pregnant, and there's risks of delivering. And the family and the patient should really understand what those risks are, at least to the best of their ability, and we need to do a good faith effort to explain it to them and say, okay, we understand. Nobody wants a stillbirth. We don't want a stillbirth. That is not our goal. But here's what it might look like in order to prevent that for this particular patient.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to dwell on the marginally clinical stuff, but I have to imagine that there's a big medical legal side to this because, you know, delivering a baby that has perhaps permanent injuries and developmental problems that maybe is due to things that you did in the ICU or didn't do is probably about the worst thing you could do as far as iatrogenic harms. But like you said, it's never probably an easy answer because it's not like we just give them a benign pill or something. The alternative is also usually something that's quite fraught with risk. So sounds like from beginning to end, this a lot of this comes down to shared decision-making and, of course, things like documentation and just making it really clear that everyone understands what's going on and, you know, what path forward everyone has elected, because there may often not be any great one.
It's true. And I mean, I think those the part that gets missed is the conversation in front saying, here's risks to mom. So the risk to baby might be more clear to everybody, but here's risks to mom. And are we all, let's talk about this before we're actually in an emergency situation. But I want to reassure everybody listening who actually takes care of these patients in the ICU, I don't want you to be afraid to care for pregnant women. I know you will be, but there's actually very little harm that can be done. There's generally, our advice is going to be, what would you do if she's not pregnant? Okay, because the difference is you need to just understand the different physiology of a pregnant woman. They're, you know, they have a compensated respiratory alkalosis. They have a creatinine of 1 is not normal in a pregnant woman. That's a big hit to the kidneys if they've got a creatinine of 1. The fundamentals about changes in their physiology is important. But I don't want you to withhold treatment. There's very few scenarios where withholding treatment is the right thing for a woman who's in the ICU and pregnant.
As far as practicalities for things like the fetal monitoring, what do the workflows usually look like around this? You know, most of the monitoring we do is being monitored by our bedside nurses, and I'd imagine in most cases they're not going to feel comfortable monitoring these strips. So who's looking at them? How often? How does this usually work? And I'm sure some of it depends on your center, but...
Yeah, that's a great question, because the logistics of this are tricky, because ICUs and labor and delivery units tend to be far from each other. Right. And ICUs tend to not have the necessary technology for the monitoring of the baby to be projected outside that unit like you do everything else. So it requires someone who is certified in electronic fetal monitoring interpretation to be at the bedside the entire time the monitoring is taking place. And that's typically a nurse. So it's one-to-one nursing, and they're just monitoring the monitor. Now, if there's a way to project it remotely, then it can be monitored remotely, because that's what we do. You know, we aren't at the bedside of every patient on continuous monitoring, but that monitor cannot be, you can't leave it for it to come back. You have to be continuously evaluating it.
So ideally, it can be broadcast to like labor and delivery, where everybody else's signal is being looked at. Many times it can't be, and then they just have to send an OB nurse to stare at it, basically.
Yeah, we jokingly call them the uterus nurse, because there's nothing...
Because they're not dealing with the mother. They're just there for the...
Right. I mean, and in some ways, it's a great resource, because then the ICU nurse has a partner who she can ask all the questions right. about that she's nervous about, but it's not the most efficient system. Now, some systems, and I've worked in some where the ICU's beds are licensed on labor and delivery, where you actually have an obstetric-specific intensive care unit. But that's not common, and it's not most places are not even going to be able to dream of something like that. So most of the time, this thing is spitting out paper that then has to be manually scanned into the electronic record because it's not being recorded in the same way as it would be if she was on the unit, because most places it's a different wiring system. They're not just set up to be plugged in anywhere and monitored from anywhere.
Okay. So the low tech solution is you have a nurse there who's watching it. And then if something bad happens, just like if we saw VTech or something, they'll call, I mean, I guess let us know, but probably call one of the obstetricians. I mean, that's probably the workflow.
Yeah, these are generally labor and delivery nurses that are managing these fetal heart rate tracings independently on all the time. So they have a very specific workflow and intervention pattern and escalation that happens depending on what they're seeing. That might mean just changing her position or fiddling with the monitors, or she might have some orders to do specific things, or she might call her charge nurse or the OB on call or whatever. She'll escalate because she's trained and certified to interpret and then it knows how to react. Just like any ICU nurse is going to troubleshoot and do all the things that they need to do before
right,
they call
the patient. Yeah. they know that some things are really bad, some things are kind of bad, some things you can see. And I guess I would hope that at some point that process links up with us again, and we can talk about, like look, we saw some of this. How are things going on your end? And are there things you can fix here? And so on and so forth.
Absolutely. So important.
All right. So that seems like it's kind of the core of how you're monitoring a fetus. Mm-hmm. What else is going on? I mean, are there other tools you have? And this, I don't know, this ranges from clinical things, like, I don't know, signs and symptoms monitor for, or physical examination things. I mean, I'm going to, like, what, poke the belly? What am I going to do? Or other imaging? I mean, of course, you guys do a lot of ultrasounds and other things. We do a lot of ultrasound, but I don't know what role it has in this situation, or lab tests. I mean, I'm sure every situation is different, but in general, are there things that you can really turn to help monitor the fetus?
The gold standard for monitoring the baby is the fetal heart rate monitor, but it can be challenging to interpret and it's not perfect. So part of the challenges in an ICU patient is that if mom is sedated, so is baby. And so that will sedate the baby's brain just like it sedates mom. And so we can see changes on the fetal heart rate monitor, that decreased variability of flatter tracing. So that can make it a little bit challenging. Other things we use really other than that is ultrasound. Now, by the time a baby is not moving on ultrasound, if it's not sedated, so if mom's not sedated and baby's not sedated, that's a very advanced in the process. So we do use ultrasound sometimes when we're trying to figure out what we're seeing on the fetal heart rate tracing, but really the overwhelming majority of what we do to evaluate the baby is the fetal monitor. Ultrasound's important if we're trying to figure out position and amniotic fluid levels and whether the baby's physically normal. Much of the time we've already determined that before the patient gets into the ICU, but not always. And also size, like how far along are they? How big is this kiddo? Do we need to be worried about anything other than what we think?
Yeah, so a lot of more subacute sorts of things. I mean, I know like a lot of the time you go into the emergency department, someone will pop it on and look at like the actual fetal heart contracting. But I imagine that's mostly a very low-tech way of doing what you're already doing with your monitoring, because you're just looking at, is it beating and how fast?
Right? Correct. Presence or absence of a heartbeat and what is the rate? It's always going to come back to the monitor. Like, what is the pattern, not just the rate?
And then everything else, I imagine, comes down to dealing with specific situations. I mean, if a pregnant woman is having abdominal pain or fluid comes out or something, I mean, I think we're all just going to give you guys a call. I mean, every once in a blue moon, it will come up that we contemplate doing a pelvic exam, but like, I think most of us like haven't touched a speculum in 10 years. Like there's very little yield in just about any imaginable circumstance, as long as you have OBGYN in your facility. I mean, if you're in some critical access hospital somewhere and there's no specialist, it's sort of its own matter. But
well, I think if you're in an ICU setting and the patient is being monitored continuously, there's not going to be a surprise birth. You're going to know if she's in labor. You're going to know what's happening based on the fetal heart rate monitoring. I think the next question is, what if we've stopped monitoring? Mom is stabilized enough. We've decided the risk to the fetus is minimal at this point. We're just going to monitor a couple times a day or every few hours. Then there's no one there. And now you're thinking, okay, do I need to be worried about what's going on with this baby? When do I need to get somebody up? I think number one, that's a very good question to ask your team. What specifically do you want me to call you for related to OB? Like, what are those specific things that you need to know about? Because you may not know what we want to know. You know, like we may be thinking, oh, I want to know if she has any, you know, if she has any discharge at all, vaginal discharge at all, or spotting or whatever. And the nurse may be thinking that's not enough to call for. Okay. So very specifically, you should absolutely ask for that. What do you need to know? But if you haven't asked or you don't know, you're looking at pain, you're looking at bleeding, leakage of fluid. Don't assume it's urine. Assume that she's broken her bag and needs to be evaluated for that. Those are by far the most common things that you're going to see that are telling you that some condition is changing. Because labor is not. the things that you see on TV where they deliver that fast, we could be, if we were blessed with labors that were that fast, that some of a lot of our stresses would frankly be lifted, because labors are not short. They're long. They're not going to happen in a minute. It's going to be a process. Now, you might notice when patients are contracting, let's say she's sedated, can't communicate with you, you're not able to ask her questions or whatever it may be, whatever her clinical scenario is, her cardiac output is going to jump like crazy when she's contracting. She's going to get tachycardic. She's going to maybe have respiratory changes. She can have some subtleties in her physiology, in her hemodynamics that you may be puzzled by. She could be contracting and not able to communicate that to you. So if you think she might be contracting, we need to put her on the monitor.
I guess the other aspect of tests that may come up, probably likely to come up in a really sick patient, is radiation. Mm-hmm. So X-rays, CT scans of whatever body part, how should we be viewing this? Because by and large, sick patients, we give very little mind to ionizing radiation. In almost every case, we say the risk of not making an important diagnosis is far, far, far more than any risk of, you know, a 10th of a percent increase in having cancer in 30 years or something. But people do worry more about the fetus. So how should people tackle this?
Treat her the same as you would if she is not pregnant. There's really no test that you can do that is going to cause an anomaly, cause the pregnancy to be lost, or cause cancer in this baby within reason. The most ionizing one is going to be either a fluoroscopy guided procedures that go for a prolonged period of time, or
so like IR has to like embolize something.
Or a barium enema, which is quite unusual in these patients. So, you know, you generally are not in that situation. Don't be worried about doing CAT scans or multiple CAT scans or chest X-rays or anything along those lines. If she needs a fluoroscopy guided procedure, the radiologist can calculate, you know, and they can do the things they need to do to minimize the radiation exposure if the test is absolutely necessary. Many times it's not necessary. It can be done in other means, you know, whatever it may be. But general rule is do what you need to do for the patient, regardless of if she's pregnant or not. Birth defects are established by the time the first trimester ends. You're not going to cause a birth defect after the first trimester. So that's something I think people really need to hear. You're not.
And that's 13 weeks. So all of these viable fetuses we're talking about, that is really not much of a concern anymore.
Correct. It's not a concern at all.
Now, I mean, I guess I should say you could have someone who is at like 8 weeks in your ICU who's pregnant or something, but I guess we could be talking about that person, but
once you've got viability, I mean, once you're out of the first trimester, we're not talking about birth defect risk. That's a first trimester phenomenon. And in fact, most of those birth defects happen long before 12 or 13 weeks.
Right. Yeah, okay. And now, granted, if you're thinking of doing like a pointless abdominal X-ray, like I think we all sort of appreciate there is a spectrum of how like relevant things are. And we probably do things that, I don't know if you need to do at all in other cases because, you know, the risk or harm seems so low. So it's probably worth giving some thought to. But don't not do a thing that does have clinical utility for pursuit of like an imaginary harm. Maybe a good example is kind of the more modern take we have, or some of us have, on giving IV contrast and maybe causing acute kidney injury these days, because it really seems like the risk of harm from this is far, far less than we used to think or than it used to be. Whereas the risk of missing an important diagnosis remains quite real. So if someone has an AKI and you want to do a CTA or something, I mean, give it some thought. Do have pause and don't do the pointless test. It's like, you know, measure twice, cut once, you know, choose wisely, whatever. But still do the thing that's necessary. And in this case, too. I mean, everyone's going to have the thought, perhaps even the patient or the radiologist. Does it need to be done? But if it does, then do it.
I completely agree. Everything you said.
All right. Brian, what else should we talk about?
Well, I think this has been really good and helpful in terms of the pregnant patient, but let's talk for a second about the postpartum patient, because I think that one also upsets people. And I'm not talking about somebody, obviously, who's like, you know, had a baby 3 months ago, although sometimes that still is like, well, should we be worried? But like someone who's just very recently had a baby, right? Maybe they've even just recently been discharged from the hospital. At what point does that really stop being a concern that we need to worry about? Or at what point do we need to say, this person's postpartum and we probably need to at least touch base with OB?
Really great questions. Just as a general rule, the farther out you get from the birth, the less likely it's going to be birth-related, with two exceptions. Hypertension sticks around a long time. You can have a lot of preeclampsia things for, you know, several weeks after birth, but cardiac. So cardiomyopathy, any kind of cardiac issues, we're finding that that's the number one cause of maternal death in the first year postpartum. Cardiac. So you've got to be thinking heart. I kind of, you know, I jokingly say postpartum women do not develop new onset asthma. It's cardiogenic pulmonary edema. And that dry cough, that hypoxemia, it's not asthma. Assume it's not asthma, assume it's the heart. And if you don't
this
think
is from like a peripartum cardiomyopathy.
Peripartum cardiomyopathy, or it could be hypertension related, that just they've got volume overload from. So what happens when they deliver the baby, it's like they get a big fluid bolus, because that placenta and the uterus don't have to be perfused anymore. And some patients tolerate this very well and others don't. They can just have like some underlying diastolic dysfunction that was never diagnosed. They go home, they get worse, they come back in, they're in pulmonary edema, and it could be because of preeclampsia, it could be some undiagnosed cardiac issue. But I can't tell you how many times I'm seeing these charts and talking to people about this, and they never even consider looking at the heart. I had a patient in clinic 2 weeks ago who had that exact scenario, got discharged within 48 hours of discharge, was readmitted with pulmonary edema, and was told that she had cardiomyopathy, but she didn't. She had diastolic dysfunction that was never diagnosed prenatally, and she got labeled with a permanent disabling diagnosis that was not what she had.
And like the timeline there is forever, because it may not go away. And you're making a diagnosis like this probably started during pregnancy some time ago, but it just may not be caught until, 10 years later, if that's when it comes
up. Well, peripartum cardiomyopathy is a very specific diagnosis, and it's near the end of pregnancy for 6 months after, but this influences people's childbearing decisions. You know, they choose not to have more children because the prognosis for future pregnancies is much worse compared to if it was just preeclampsia that we dealt with. Now, I don't want to minimize preeclampsia, but they're completely different scenarios with different degrees of risk. And people they carry this diagnosis with them. It becomes almost an identity, you know, of what they're. So I think we have a responsibility to consider, be thorough in our consideration. So it's a really good question of how does the pregnancy impact this? But what I would say is, in the first week postpartum, assume it's related to the pregnancy. Okay. Beyond the week, consider it for the first 6 weeks. After that, I go straight to the heart. Because if it's going to be pregnancy related, it's typically cardiac. And I'm not even getting into the mental health side of things, but cardiac is going to be your big player beyond 6 weeks.
We sometimes reflect that pregnant people are at a somewhat hypercoagulable state, so maybe more risk for DVTs and Ps and things. How long does that last?
Weeks. In fact, they are definitely hypercoagulable, and their greatest risk of clot formation is in the first 6 weeks postpartum. So for women who have had a prior VTE of any kind, sometimes we anticoagulate them through the whole pregnancy. Sometimes it's just postpartum. Sometimes it's just postpartum if they have a C-section. So it depends on its degrees of risk, but that postpartum period is really big. And yeah, I think that's a really good point, Brandon, that VTE risk in that first 6 weeks that's a big player there.
All right, Steph, closing thoughts on this. What do you want people to go off and kind of bear in mind about this patient population? Especially, it's just such it is an uncommon thing, unless you're in some hyper-specialized women's hospital. But, you know, we're so used to dealing with our normal things, and it's so easy to get thrown a loop when one of them happens to be pregnant. What do you want people to bear in mind?
Well, I don't want people to be afraid of pregnant women. I want them to be respectful that pregnant women have different physiology. And so learn what you need to learn about these patients, and don't be afraid to ask for help. Find out what your resources are. Who are you going to call? What do you have maternal fetal medicine specialists? Because all of your ICU patients, if you've got an MFM, they need to be involved in that patient's care, they're a huge resource for you. But don't be afraid to kind of ask questions and learn what it is you need to know. It's what I've dedicated my career to, is educating people about how are pregnant women different? How does it matter? Second thing is, pregnancy doesn't, if a pregnant woman is critically ill, it does not mean she needs to be delivered. And if she needs to be delivered, it does not mean she needs a cesarean. She might not, but it doesn't automatically mean delivery or major abdominal surgery. But we do need to talk through what that looks like. And honestly, I think this is a perfect scenario for simulation. Imagine your worst scenario, practice it, talk about it, get everybody involved and work through it. Be prepared.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I think this has been great. And I think that's really good advice, right? To practice, you know, and that's one of the things we try to do in our sim lab is pick stuff that particularly doesn't happen a lot, right? Because the scary stuff that happens a lot eventually becomes not scary, right? Because we do it all the time. So scary stuff that doesn't happen a lot, but where the stakes are really high and people tend to freak out, I think you're right, is the perfect candidate for a good simulation, a good sim lab day. Any further resources or anything else that you want to add to where folks can get some more information if they want, if maybe they're like, I don't even know where to start with
this my stuff. Partners and I actually created, we have two things. We have our podcast, the Critical Care Obstetrics Podcast, which you can find anywhere, where we talk about all kinds of scenarios. We interview patients and their experiences. We do a lot of education on there about what you need to know about high-risk and critically ill pregnant women from the obstetric perspective. And we have our academy, the Critical Care Obstetrics Academy, which you can find at our website, clinicalconceptsinob.com, where we teach everything you need to know about critical care OB. And it's intended for anyone at the bedside, nurses, physicians, PAs, RTs, ED, anywhere.
That's great. Well, we'll link to all that stuff in the show notes. So thanks for joining us. And just a reminder, everybody, this is just our opinions. We don't represent our various institutions necessarily. And this should be taken as general education and not specific medical advice. Thanks a lot, and we will see you next time.